You're listening to Auto D, coming at you live.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to the Auto D Show here on Dave Pratt's Star Worldwide Networks, broadcasting from high above Camelback Road in beautiful Scottsdale, Arizona. I am your host, Otto Doniolo, and this evening, hanging out in New York City, I believe, is my guest, jazz artist and author, Michael Wolff, who has released 21 albums and has a new book out from Redwood Publishing called On That Note. And in the book, Michael discusses his life in jazz, including his time as musical director for Arsenio Hall's groundbreaking late-night talk show, his battle against rare form of cancer, and the difficulties of dealing with Tourette syndrome in both his personal and professional life. So we got a lot to talk about. Michael will be with me right after this first cut from the Fervor Records catalog called Sunday Morning Sunshine by my dear friend Francine Reed, who has spent the last 25 or so years on the road with Lyle Lovett and his large band. Check it out.
Without any reason why, captured my heart under a moonlit sky. You and the stars brushed the clouds from my eyes, led me from the darkness into the light. But I gave you my heart. Lord knows my yesterdays were cloudy and blue, but you took my tomorrows and made them sparkle.
Listening to Auto D, coming at you live.
And that was Sunday Morning Sunshine by Francine Reed here on the Otto D Show, which is brought to you in part by my good friends at Fervor Records and also by TheRecordingArtist.com, where every Wednesday evening I record bands live online while you watch. To learn more, visit TheRecordingArtist.com and be sure to check out my companion TV show on Amazon Prime called The Recording Artist. It's kind of cool. But if you really want to talk about cool, then we have to talk about tonight's guest, because tonight on the Otto D Show, Mr. Michael Wolff, who finds himself smack dab in the middle of a pretty incredible life and a pretty awesome career, is going to have a little chat with us. Michael, let me know if you're still there on the line.
I'm still here, Otto.
Awesome, man. Thanks for taking the time tonight to chat. I know it's a little late on the East Coast.
Well, I'm a jazz musician, man. I don't go to bed early, so this is perfect timing for me.
I hear you.
I dig it.
In fact, you've got a gig in September on the West Coast, and I think on the 18th in Oakland. So are you staying on the East Coast until then, or are you headed back west real quick?
Yeah, I'm in the East Coast for a while. I'm always back and forth. We have a place in New York and a place in L.A., and because my wife and my two sons are actors, you know, Polly Draper, and then Matt Wolff and Alex Wolff, who are in their 20s. So everybody's back and forth a lot. I'm playing, yeah, I'm a professor at NYU, New York University, in the music department, the jazz department. So I'm in New York, kind of based here during the school year. But now, because of the COVID thing being better and the pandemic not being such a drag, I'm traveling again. So I'm going to be out in Oakland on the 18th at Piedmont Piano. Actually, the first show sold out at 5, but they're doing a 7:30 show. They added on. And then on the 21st of September, I'll be in L.A. at Mr. Musichead Gallery, which is on Sunset. I'm really excited. I'll be performing with a jazz trio and a string quartet, a couple pieces. I wrote a big piece called Pandemia during the pandemic. That's a 22-minute concerto and cool. Three movements. And then I wrote another piece. So, yeah, I'm really excited to be just out playing again.
Yeah, the world really got shut down for a while. It's amazing the impact it had on our industry, you know, across the board.
Oh, God, yeah.
But I guess first, on behalf of your fans, you know, around the world, I just want to say thanks for all the wonderful music and congratulations on the book. Is this your first book?
Man, it's my first book, and it might be my last book. I don't know, but I'm really proud of that book. It took me years to write this thing, you know, because I would say about 9 years total, because, you know, I wrote this memoir. It's called On That Note, and it really is the story of my life as a musician and a person, you know, all the things I went through. And I heard in your introduction, you know, about having gone through a really bad spate, 4 years of an incurable cancer. And luckily, I found a doctor up at Memorial Sloan Kettering here in New York who saved my life and figured out a cure. And then, having had Tourette's syndrome all my life. So I had a lot to talk about, and then all the great musicians I got to play with.
Oh, my
with.
Gosh, yeah.
Sonny Rollins and Cannonball Adderley, and then Stevie Wonder and Prince, and, you know, all these great people. And so I was really, I just started writing it first, actually about 9 years ago, and I started writing a how-to book in terms of how to be a musician. I thought, well, I'll write about how to be a sideman as a keyboard player, how to be a conductor, because I conducted a lot of symphonies and a lot of, you know, TV shows, and, you know, how to be a leader, how to be a follower, how to be a composer and arranger. I started writing it, and after about 100 pages of that, I read through it. I went, man, I like the stories. I like the fun stories. I don't really want to write a how-to book. I want to write my story, you know?
Yeah,
so then I went back and I started writing, and it took me about 2 more years of writing till I could make it sound personal, like it was me speaking, you know, at least close to that. So then I started writing, and then I got sick for about 4 years, and I basically didn't do too much writing. And then when I got well, I thought, I got to write this book for sure. So having it out there, it just came out in March of this year, and it was a bestseller at Amazon already. And I'm just thrilled to have it out. It really means a lot to me. So when I'm going to these gigs, I'm doing like these concerts in Oakland and in L.A., I do some readings from the book, and sometimes I'll have actors come do some readings. You know, I'm friends with a lot of great actors, or I'll just do it myself and, you know, try to coordinate the music with what I'm talking about in the book.
Yeah, that's a great idea. And how has the response been from the friends and family related to the book?
Fantastic, you know, really good. I mean, I didn't write a book that was a tell-all or anything.
Right.
I just told all about me, but I didn't put anybody down or, you know.
Sure.
I could write one of those books, too, but that's not what I did.
What's the point? Exactly.
So nobody was insulted so far.
Well, let me ask you this. Just from what I've read, and I've only been perusing emails from your publicist and your website, but just the comments, the way you write in those are great. I haven't had a chance to see the book. I haven't gotten a copy, but I'm absolutely going to pick it up just from what I know about it. But I wanted to ask you, in writing this book, being the first book, would you describe the process as being more therapeutic or arduous? Was it more effort or was it more good for you?
I don't think it was therapeutic. It was just something I wanted to do because, you know, when I started writing it, I was in my early 60s. Or maybe I was really about, I don't know, 60 and or 61. And I thought, well, yeah, I've done a lot of stuff. I feel like I got a good memory. Maybe I'll just write stuff. So I didn't really have a plan of what the book was going to be. Like I said, I started to do the how-to book, and I thought, well, wait, let me just sit down and expand on these stories. So I didn't write it in the order that the book is now. The book is pretty chronological.
Correct.
I wrote the ideas that came to me. I thought, let me write about these great musicians that I love, and I toured with. Let me write about some great stories and experiences I had with Cannonball Adderley, a great saxophonist. So let me write about the Arsenio Hall show and all the great people that I got to meet and play with on that show. Or let me write about my cancer, and I kind of dealt with that. And that I did not want to write about.
Right.
But I made myself do it, and that was kind of cool. That might have been therapeutic, that part. And then just, I wrote a lot about, you know, I grew up in the 50s in the South, and then moved to Berkeley, California in 61. I wrote a lot about racism, and I wrote a lot about, being a white guy and playing with all these African-American musicians, and they were my idols and my peers and my employers, and they're coming from the South with so many racist people, even the people I loved in a lot of people in my family were that way, and I just wanted to be real about my experience growing up in this country, in this world at that time, you know, and I was in Berkeley, California, during the 60s, man, and, you know, we were radicals, you know. My mom was a socialist, so we used to put on our armbands and go march, you know. First it was the free speech movement, and then it was, against the Vietnam War. And then I didn't even know when we were little. We were just going these big, long marches and go to the park, and then we'd see Joan Baez and Pete Seeger singing, you know. And then I figured out politically what was happening. So, I just wanted to just show what I've been through and make some sense of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, man, that's amazing. And just in your response there, you just mentioned so many things we could talk about. And I was even thinking you could extract a number of books from your book. You know, you could really write a book about your years on the Arsenio Hall show. You know, just as one.
I know. I think I wrote a pretty big chapter about it. I could write it definitely. I mean, it was 5.5 years, and it changed my life. You know, I knew Arsenio from when I was musical director with the jazz singer Nancy Wilson, and I was a musical director for 5 years. And about midway through, Arsenio became our opening act doing stand-up comedy.
Oh, okay.
And he and I, you know, everybody was older than I was in the band, but he and I are about the same age. So we just became buddies on the road, and we would hang out, and I loved comedy. And sometimes I'd say, hey, I wrote a joke. Would you say it? He goes, I'll say it. I'll say anything. Okay. And he'd try out my jokes, and sometimes they're good and sometimes they weren't. But he had the ability to make everything seem funny. He's just really great. So as we became friends, he was like, you know, one day I'm going to have a talk show, man, and you're going to do music. And I just said, yeah, that sounds great. I didn't know if it was going to ever happen. So when he got the talk show, you know, he had already done the movie Coming to America with Eddie Murphy, and he had been a substitute for Joan Rivers on her talk show. And we always kept in touch. Whenever I came out to L.A., because I was living in New York, but I come out to L.A. to play. He and I would get together, and he had a basketball game with a bunch of other great actors, you know, Samuel Jackson, people like that. And I'd go play basketball with those guys, and he and I would hang out. And he would always talk to me about his dreams, you know. Mm-hmm. And so when he got this show, I was talking to him, and I said, man, congratulations. And he goes, well, you know, Mike, I'm thinking about actually having an all-woman band. I said, that is a great idea. He said, could you help me find some women that would be great for the band? So I started nosing around. You know, I was in New York, but I started trying to find people. And then a week or two later, he called. He says, I've changed my mind. I want you to come out and be my musical director. And I went, man, I don't know if I want to move to L.A. So he goes, come on, what do you want to do in New York? Going to be a male model or a theater actor? Come on, man.
That's funny.
So I went out there, and, you know, I had no money. I'll be honest. I was broke. I had no credit. You know, I'd been a jazz musician, and it was a scuffling period of time for me. I'd gotten off the road from traveling. I didn't want to travel anymore. And I'd spent about 5 years in New York really trying acting and stand-up and still playing gigs. And, you know, it was kind mm-hmm. of a lost 5 years, I call it, in my book.
Mm-hmm.
And then I, you know, with Arsenio, I went out there. I had to rent a wrecked car for $10 a day. I stayed at a friend's house. I drove up to the Paramount lot, which is a gigantic, beautiful, you know, movie studio. And
right.
I drove in there and met with him. And he whispered to me, when you walk out of here, I want you to have the job. So I met his production guy and I met his producer. And I walked out and they called me and said, you got the job. I thought, yeah, okay, well, it might go for 13 weeks, so I'm not going to buy anything or
right.
move out here or even buy a car. I didn't have a car. Oh, I sublet a friend's apartment. I would just have to take a cab and get rides.
I love it.
First 13 weeks, and I just put all my money in the bank account, you know, savings account. And then I thought, this thing might be a hit, man. And then all of a sudden, it started going. I rented an apartment, and, you know, I bought a car for $550, a Buick with Sabre, 1975, you know.
Uh-huh.
I still kept living like I was a scuffling musician
well,
for quite
knew,
a long
you knew
time,
how man. Quickly you could go back to what it was.
I know, and I wanted to save my money just in case,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
But as it started going a couple of years, I went, oh, this is pretty cool. But I never bought a good car, I'll just tell you that. I'm not a car guy.
Mm-hmm.
But, anyway, yeah, it was a great experience doing Arsenio Hall. You know, we went in every day. I was a band leader, so I had to do all the arrangements. And,
right.
oh, man, that took forever. I'd have to go in at 8 in the morning. We shot around, I think, 5:15 every day or 5:30 in the afternoon. And so because in those days we had to get it out to the East Coast. We were in L.A., right, and it needed to be on the East Coast by maybe 10 o'clock or something, 11 o'clock.
Right.
They would put it out on the, you know, on the satellite. And, you know, it was a fantastic thing. I had a great band, wonderful musicians, John B. Williams on bass and Peter Mounu on guitar and Star Parodi on keyboards and Terry Lynn Carrington started on drums and then Chuck Morris. And, you know, we could play with anybody. So the gig was really, it was kind of like we were the best wedding band you ever heard. We had to play all these different kinds of music with all the stars, you know.
Right.
So it was an interesting great job. And then Arsenio loved music and he let me play jazz or whatever I wanted. But, well, you know, that was really the job, was to play top 40 music. And we played with a lot of rappers. And, you know, we did all kinds of stuff.
Oh, yeah. I remember the show, you know. And what's really
right?
interesting is
yeah.
I can't even imagine all the people you got to play with. And a lot of times you had to be, number one, thrilled for the opportunity to get into it with them. And secondly, I bet you discovered a lot about some of these artists that you really weren't aware of when it came to their music, when you had to rearrange them for the show.
Well, yeah. We only had a five-piece band, and some of them, the only one I failed at was Seal. He did his first album with Trevor Horn,
right.
producing of this great English producer, and he had like a million parts. I could never get it together with our band. It was my fault. I just couldn't figure out how to arrange it, so he ended up doing it with his guitar player, which was great and smart. But, you know, usually we could really get close to the sound of the record. That's what
right.
I was trying to
right.
do. So they felt really good, you know.
Yeah. And on top of all these artists, you actually met your future wife when she was a guest on the show.
I did. I met my wife, Polly Draper. She was a star of a show called 30-something. And she came on the show, and Arsenio loved her because she was funny and crazy. So he had her back all the time. When I was living in New York, I was doing stand-up comedy from the piano, sort of like a jazz Victor Borga. I don't know if people remember Victor Borga, but he was a classical pianist, so it was really great.
And
so I was kind of doing a jazz version of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked at the Improv, and I had a 9:15 slot. And then at 10 o'clock at the bar, I'd be sitting there. They didn't pay you, but you could get maybe a couple free beers. And I'd watch the TV, and I was always turned to ABC, and there was 30-something. And I'd love this woman, this long-legged brunette with a really hoarse voice, Polly Draper. So when I saw she was going to be a guest on the show, I thought, oh, I hope I meet her. And then I was in the hair and makeup room, and there she was. So, you know, we really flirted and chatted and everything. And I didn't have the guts to ask her out, but I found out where she lived, and I sent some flowers. It was a long story, man. She was doing a movie somewhere. Anyway, finally, I got her to go on a date with me, and we went out to dinner, and, you know, the rest was history, man.
Well, I love to hear that. I love to hear those stories, man. I'm a sucker for a romantic comedy or a real love story. And I think the fact that
it was romantic comedy. You know, when I found out where she lived, the way I found out she lived is, you know, at the show they didn't want to tell me. You know,
of course.
It would have really been nice. They said, "Well, here's her agent. Why don't you just call her agent?
Why don't you just stalk her agent?"
Yeah. So I leave a message. I don't hear back from her. I go, man. So I snuck into the producer's office and I pulled out the sheet that showed where the limo picked her up. And I got 101 roses.
Wow.
And I dropped them at her door. It was from 6 blocks from where I lived in West Hollywood.
Oh,
so
wow.
It was really easy. And I put a note. And then I didn't hear from her for 3 or 4 days, 5 days. So then I drove by there. And they were just sitting there wilted. I went, oh, man. So I threw them away. I went and got another one. Now, I'll be honest, there was a place called Arturo's Flower Shop, and they were 101 roses, $19.99. So it wasn't killing me financially. They were kind of old. But, you know,
yeah.
I wanted to make a splash.
Yeah.
So I did it a couple of times, and finally, after 2 or 3 weeks, I got a call from her. She said, oh, well, I didn't realize who you were. And, that, you know, I thought you were a guy I'd met at the dog park or something, you know, blah, blah, blah. I finally got her to go out with me. I was playing a benefit concert for PETA, you know, the fur and leather, you know, save animals people. And
right.
I did that, and she came to that. And we just started slowly going out, you know, and it turned into a great relationship, you know.
Well, and you guys.
Obviously, we got married.
Yeah.
Well, we just, on August 29th, celebrated our 30th wedding anniversary.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
And you guys have worked together as well.
We have. After she finished 30-something, you know, she did a lot of movies and TV, but she got the idea that she wanted to write. She'd gone to Yale School of Drama and Yale undergraduate. She was an English major. She's really smart and really good at writing. And she just decided while she was, you know, acting on 30-something in various shows, she would write a little bit for her character or maybe come up with an idea and they'd let her do it. So she had the idea to write a script. So she wrote a script based on me and my Tourette syndrome called The Tick Code. And it was about a jazz piano kid who was 12 years old who had Tourette's. He was really talented. And his idol was a sax player played by Gregory Hines. It was the last movie Gregory did. And Polly's character played the boy's mom. And then she has a relationship with Gregory Hines. And anyway, I did the score to that. That was the first project we did together. It was a big success. We really had a lot of fun doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we've done a few other things.
So the Nickelodeon series. The Nickelodeon
huh?
series. The Nickelodeon series,
yeah,
with your boys. Was she
That's
directing
right,
that as well?
Yeah, what happened was we have our two sons, Nat Wolf and Alex Wolf.
Right.
Or now if you look it up, Wolf of Two Fs, they're all big movie
yeah.
stars. Nat is 27, Alex is 24, as well as being singer, songwriter, musicians. But anyway, when they were little, Nat was maybe 6 or 7, and he was into music, but he wrote a sign on it, put it in front of his door of his room. It said, "I want to be a child actor, A-K-T-O-R.
Right.
And so my wife said, "Oh no, I don't want him to go out and get all that rejection." And so I think she just wrote a little fun family movie that we're going to shoot about a band that's as famous as the Beatles. Like,
that's so
it was
funny.
A mock documentary, like, you know, I don't know, like,
Spinal Tap.
Little Rascals meet Spinal Tap kind
right.
of thing, you know? And so then we shot it, and it wasn't very expensive, and then we tried to sell it, and people loved it. It did really well. Nobody really wanted to buy it. So we entered it in film festivals, and at the Hamptons Film Festival, I'll Be Hecked, who had been president of Nickelodeon and had left, but he had a production deal, said, "I want to make a show out of this." We didn't really want to have our kids on TV, but they said, "Well, what would it take?" And we said, "Let's just shoot in the summer in New York." They said, "Great."
Okay.
So my wife was the showrunner and the main writer and director, and I ended up playing the father because I played the father in the movie because we were just messing around, right?
Right.
And then the movie was cool because Polly said, "Well, if we're going to sell that this band of these little kids is really great, we're going to have famous people saying that they're great. So she got a lot of her friends, like Julianne Moore and Uma Thurman and Tony Shalhoub and, you know, all these people.
Awesome.
Who always have little cameos, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really cool because they would say, oh, I love the band, or they would show them hanging out with them or whatever it was, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we started doing the show, and we shot it in Brooklyn, Greenpoint, and we did 3 seasons of it, and it was a blast. You know, I did the underscore, but each episode was based on their songs, because in the movie, all the songs are written by my sons. You know,
right.
They're just such good singer-songwriters. And that's what happened. We continued so that every episode of every season was based on one of the other songs.
Mm-hmm.
And then all the episode was kind of written to include the song. And then I wrote the underscore as well as played the father. So it was a family of four. You know, we were just working together all during that time. We'd start maybe in July, and we go through Halloween, you know, the end of October. So we wanted them to be able to go to regular school, which they did. It just worked out fantastically. It was a great experience, and I mean, you're lucky if you can have experience with your family, and you're creating great stuff, and you're having a lot of fun.
Exactly.
Oh, we'd come home every night, we'd have dinner, and a lot of the kids, some of the kids, you know, lived they and their parents lived out of town, so they'd stay with us. We'd all sit at the dinner table and eat dinner, and while we're eating, we'd go over our lines for the next day. And then if everybody had their lines, they could go and watch
That's
the
cool.
OC, because that
so
was
funny.
What was happening at the time.
That's pretty
it
cool.
It was great.
Well, listen, man, before we get off of that, just for a second, since we're on family, I just wanted to mention a fact I found just for listeners that I was fascinated by, and that is that your wife, Polly, is actually a direct descendant of Francis Cook, who was a passenger on the actual Mayflower. That's pretty cool.
Cool. I didn't know that.
Well,
I don't know if she knows it. I got to tell her.
Really? We have to check that out, because I found that. Maybe it's on her IMDb page. I can't remember where it came from. But
that's interesting.
I dug it up someplace.
I had no idea about that.
And I thought, that's an interesting fact that not many people can claim.
Well, my family has Jews from Latvia and Estonia, so we didn't get on any of those boats. They came over in the late 1800s to avoid conscription into the Russian Tsar's army.
Right.
So it's a little different story.
Yeah, exactly. But
anyway, that's interesting. That's interesting to know.
Well, then getting back on the book just for a second, I wanted to ask you, read a couple quotes, I guess. One quote was Sonny Rollins. You mentioned working with him, and I'd like to talk about that. But before we do, he's quoted as having said, "Michael Wolff is a great guy and one of the greatest musicians I've ever played with. I hope this book sells because he owes me money." I thought that was pretty funny.
Isn't that a hip jazz musician's quote? Yeah,
oh,
he's such
absolutely.
A great guy. You know, we still talk every few months. He's a sweetie. You know, he's 92 now.
Wow.
Oh, we stayed good friends. Yeah,
that's pretty cool. And another thing was, I think you kind of got around to the answering this question for me earlier when we were talking about Arsenio Hall, but his quote, too, was, "Michael Wolff may have been the first true genius I met in my career. He helped to teach this young, very green Cleveland comic the show business ropes." And then he goes on to speak about how excited he is that you're telling the story in the book, you know, because of your personal friendship. But I was struck by his remark about mentioning that you taught in the ropes of show business. And I wondered, that seems like a lot beyond the job description of music director. So I wondered about that early relationship. But it sounds like since he was opening for you, that's really where you guys had an opportunity to share a lot.
Yeah, sometimes we were roommates on the road. We would mostly just have rooms and, you know, we'd all be in the same hotel. We'd eat together. I don't really know what ropes I showed him, but you know, I had been doing it longer with Nancy,
yeah.
So I wouldn't go on the road, and I don't really remember showing him any ropes.
Well, maybe,
but I'm glad he thinks
that. I was going to say, maybe you didn't show him, but maybe he was watching. Maybe he learned a lot about being on the road.
Yeah, he's a very observant person,
mm-hmm.
And you know, he was ready though, man. That was a guy that was always going to be successful. He's just a really intelligent, sweet cat. So I knew that was going to work out. Yeah.
Well, listen, how did you meet Sonny Rollins? How did that relationship start?
Oh, well, you know, once you get going in this business, I got going when I went to college for 2 years to study music. But in my day, they had Berklee School of Music to study jazz. That was it. I didn't think about that. So I went to UCLA because I was living in Berklee, and it was a California university.
Mm-hmm.
And man, it cost me $225 a quarter to go to that school.
Wow.
I mean, it was just, they didn't even consider it tuition. They just called it student fees. So it was affordable. Yeah. And I studied classical music there, you know, and I wasn't a great classical musician, but I'd studied classical piano. And then at the same time, they had a jazz band, and I formed another jazz band. They're a big band. So, you know, I wanted to be in L.A. or New York, and that's where I got into school. Mm-hmm. And but during the summers, I'd go back to Berkeley, and there was a great record company in Berkeley called Fantasy Records.
Yep.
And I lived with some guys, some musicians, in a house. And one of them had a job working at Fantasy Records writing out music lead sheets for rock and roll musicians. Because in those times, if you wanted to copyright a song, you had to actually turn in sheet music. Nowadays, right. You can send in a, you know, digital or whatever. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's easy music. So, but, you know, like Creedence Clearwater, those guys, they didn't write out music. They just recorded their music.
Right.
So we had to write it out for them. So he had that job. He said, hey, you want that job? It pays $10 a, you know, I think it's $10 a chart. I go, sure, man. I don't have a job. So I did it. But I didn't do a good job. The guy goes, man, you wrote all these different notes. Why don't you just make everything an eighth note? It'd be simple. And I said, well, that's not what they sang. I'm writing exactly what they sang. He goes, you're fired, kid. So so I'm walking around Fantasy, and I look in this room, and I see Cal Jader. And I had heard Cal Jader when I was at UCLA. So I went in, and I introduced himself. This is how cocky I was. I go, hey, Cal, I'm Mike Wolf. I'm a jazz pianist. I'm ready to play in your band. Just like that. Because I was young. I just thought
that's what it takes, you know.
Yeah. So he said, well, I kid. And this was like maybe the beginning of the summer, June. He says, well, you know, in July, I'm going to be at El Matador in San Francisco. Why don't you come sit in? I went, great. And I forgot about it. It was a couple months. And then my roommate, that same guy who'd got me the job at Fantasy, said, hey, I see Cal Jader's at El Matador. He invited you to sit in. Why don't you go? So I drove over there. But I wasn't 21. I was 19. They wouldn't Uh-oh. Let me in the club. So I drove there every night. And finally, the Sunday, it was 2 weeks. So the Sunday of the first week, I'd gone there Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. That Sunday, there was a really beautiful waitress, a little older than I was. You know, she just snuck me in. She said, all right, come on. Gave me a great seat. Cal saw me, and the last set he had me sit in on piano. And I played really well. In those days, I wasn't consistent. But I played a really good set. So he says, all right, come back next week. And I came back. He'd let me play every night the next week at the last set. And then he offered me the gig to go with the band to Arizona to play in Tucson at the Burning Flame. You won't know that club. But it was a great gig for 2 weeks. And I didn't realize he was sort of checking me out, you know?
Right.
But after that 2 weeks, I got the gig. He says, okay, you got the gig. It's $250 on the road, $225 a week, and $225 at home, but you got to pay for your own hotel, you know. It wasn't a lucrative gig, but for me, I'd never made any kind of money. I was thrilled, and I loved the music. Great musicians, you know, Dick Burke on drums, John Hurt on bass, you know, great band. And so the second gig was the Monterey Jazz Festival Latin Jam.
Oh, my gosh.
In the afternoon, and it was a big, amazing concert with Cal and all these great Latin players like Armando Perazzo percussion and Willie Bobo and Timbales and Al McKibben on bass and Clark Terry and Dizzy Gillespie on trumpet.
Oh,
so there I am playing. A record came out a few years ago on this. So I'm playing Fender Rhodes piano, electric piano with my wah-wah pedal and all these pedals. And these guys are playing this music. And I'm thinking, these old guys, they're lucky to have me. I'm going to show them all the hip stuff, you know. That's how I thought about it then. So, you know, that was how I got started. You know, I started with Cal. And once I did with Cal, I made 3 records with him.
Mm-hmm.
And I just started meeting people. So after 2 years, I got the gig with Ayrton Marrero and Flora Purim, and I toured with them for a year. And I had met Cannonball, actually, when I was in college. Cannonball Adderley was a guest at it. I was a ringer, actually, at the Alameda Junior College. My piano teacher, Bill Bell, was the head of that program. And Cannon and I hit it off. He always remembered me. So I had moved to New York to join Ayrton's band. I was 22 years old and 74. And the drummer, Roy McCurdy, came over to our house where I was living, our apartment. And he said, you know, our drummer, our pianist, Hal Galper's leaving. So I said, I'm going to call Cannonball. Give me his number. I said, hey, it's Mike Wolf. I just called to say hi. He goes, Mike, hey, man, I got a, you know, and I just got the gig like that. Yeah. I just lucked out.
Like good time.
You know, and that was the gig of my life. I loved playing with Cannonball. And then I got with Cannonball. Then I was with Jean Luc Ponty. Then Thad Jones, Mel Lewis. And then the drummer with Sonny Rollins, he was putting together a new band with this guy, Eddie Moore. And he just gave Sonny my number. Sonny called me, and I did a couple of rehearsals. And I got that gig. You know, it was kind of just all happening for me then.
Mm-hmm.
So I just went on the road with Sonny. I was with him for 2 years, and that was really a lot of fun.
And is that where is that when you hooked up with Nancy in terms of becoming her music director?
Hook up with Nancy? No, that was interesting. My relationship with Nancy Wilson was through a great guy named John Levy, who was the first African-American guy to be a manager in that jazz business. He had started out as a bass player with George Shearing, but then he just started doing business for George. And then all of a sudden, he started managing all these guys. So when I was with Cal Jader, John Levy was his manager. When I was with Cannonball, John Levy was his manager. Hmm. So, you know, Nancy Wilson was looking for a conductor, and John said, well, you should get Mike Wolf. You know, he's played with all these guys. He's great. But I had never conducted. So he called me to do that gig, and I said, I don't know, man. I said, those guys wear tuxedos, don't they? I don't want to wear a tuxedo. He said, yeah, they do. But he told me what it paid. I went, all right, I'm there, man.
There you go.
So, but yeah, I thought, oh, I'm going to go get a used tuxedo. So I went to get a used tuxedo. And while I was trying it on, some guy came in and stole money out of my regular pants. So I didn't have any money.
Gosh.
So he wired, John Levy wired me some money to buy a tuxedo. And, you know, I took the lesson, I think, in conducting. I'd never conducted.
Mm-hmm.
So I took a lesson in conducting, and they flew me out to Kansas City, where she was playing with the Kansas City Symphony. And I sat on the side of the stage with the music, and I watched it as the other conductor did it, and I saw what that guy did. So I had time before my gig, so I just took it home and studied the music, took another little lesson in conducting, and just started off, and that was it, you know.
That's interesting.
That was on-the-job training. I learned to conduct. I learned to arrange. I sang duets with her. I mean, I didn't learn anything. It wasn't like I went to school and knew I had to do this stuff, and then I got all these jobs like everybody does now.
Yeah.
I learned everything I learned on the bandstand, whether it was with Cal Jader. I had to use my ear to learn all these songs I'd never heard of, you know, all these old jazz songs I didn't know. Mm-hmm. And then with, you know, Airto, I had to learn how to play Latin. A different, you know, Cal was a certain kind of Latin music. Airto was Brazilian with all these different time signatures. He says, oh, we'll do that. You just float on top. You know, I learned that. Then with, you know, Cannonball, I was ready for that one.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, each one, I learned a lot. I learned a lot from the person. You know, they would show me stuff. And I was hungry. You know, I would practice every day in the afternoon before the gig. You know, I was still studying classical and playing Ravel. And, you know, just I lived, ate, drank, breathed, slept music.
Yeah.
That was it, you know.
Well, since Nancy Wilson, have you had other opportunities to conduct?
You know, I've written a couple pieces. Yeah, I wrote a whole orchestra thing for myself. Actually, I didn't conduct, but I wrote an orchestra thing for Jazz Piano Trio and Orchestra so I could do Pops concerts.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that for a while. But I conducted for a few singers, but really, lately, I've been writing music for myself for Jazz Piano Trio and String Quartet. And mm-hmm. So I'm conducting the String Quartet now. And it's just so natural to be back conducting. I really enjoy it.
That's
I really
cool.
love conducting. I always conduct from the piano. Mm-hmm. And then I stand up and then I sit down. You know, it's just the way I did it.
Yeah.
So it's really comfortable.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. I would think that conducting, I've never had any aspect experience with that in my life, but it just seems like it's quite an interesting blend of reading the technical information or reading the notes and keeping up with the score, but it's emotionally conveying how you want this thing to calm in the midst of them knowing what they're doing. So that's got to be a really interesting conversation.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm not conducting like, you know, Rite of Spring or something. I'm conducting, when I first got with this guy Tom Pearson, who was conducting The Wiz on Broadway. I said, hey, I gotta conduct for Nancy Wilson. He goes, well, who's a drummer? I said, Roy McCurdy. He says, just count him off and you'll be cool, man. You know, play the piano and then cut it off.
And wave your arms at.
So I mean, I didn't, but you know, sometimes there would be parts where I was just conducting them. And so when I you know, the first gig I did with her was at a place called the Cherry Hill Inn in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. It was near Atlantic City. Yeah, it was with, I think we were opening for the Spinners. The Spinners were opening for us or something like that, which was a really cool R&B singing group. And so there was a nice big band with strings, a nice string section. So I had to conduct. So I didn't know what I was going to do. So I just decided, man, I want to wear my tuxedo. I'm going to stand up straight, and I'm going to just pretend like I'm a conductor. And I knew how to go 1, 2, 3, 4 or 1, 2, 3. And I knew to invite the orchestra in with my other hand. And I just said, I'm going to be simple. And so I was very simple, and then I played the piano a lot. At the end of the 2 weeks, the concert master, you know, the lead violinist, shook my hand and said, you know, you're one of the best conductors we've ever had. You're so simple, easy to follow. You're a great pianist. I went, wow, that worked out great.
That's cool.
So, you know, but when I've conducted Pops concerts, you know, for Nancy or whatever, all my own stuff, you stand in front of a 60-piece or 70-piece orchestra, it's more thrilling and more exciting than a rock group, really. I mean, you give a downbeat to tune into an A, and everybody's playing that A below middle C. I mean, it's thrilling. Yeah. You feel it go, at least for me, I feel it go all the way up through my body.
Yeah,
you
know? I can imagine. Well, listen, a couple other things. There's so much, Michael, that we could talk about. And I do want to talk a little bit about the health issues and your experience with all of that. But before we do, one more music thing. I have one quick question, and that was, your earliest album listed on your discography was 1994's Columbia Records release titled Michael Wolff. Was that your first release as an artist?
Oh, it was, man. I was 40 years old.
Okay. And you had 21
I played on
releases,
a lot of other people's records.
Exactly.
I wasn't smart enough. I should have started making my own records because I had opportunities. I wasn't a smart businessman, I'll tell you. I just wanted to play the piano and compose music. So Cal Jader had said when I was, you know, 21, hey, I want to produce a record, and I want to get all these studio guys. I thought, I don't want those studio guys. You know, I wasn't smart. I was not smart in that way.
Yeah.
So I didn't really make my first record until I was 40. I wish I'd made my first record when I was 25, you know.
Sure.
But, you know, it's just the way it went down. So I'm trying to make up for lost time.
Well, listen, there's a song you wrote called Tell Me that I enjoyed watching the making of video, and I really love the tune, and I just thought it would be it'd be fun. Oh. The concept, from my point of view as a producer engineer guy, the concept to first of all decide you want a children's choir, and then secondly bring them on, it can be as much trouble as it can be good, depending on who you have and how it goes. Sounds like it was a great idea, but I thought it would be interesting to hear your take on how you found this choir that sang on that track and that whole story.
Well, you know who the engineer was on that, Roger Nichols.
Yeah. Superstar.
Here's how I found the choir. I was, I had my band, Michael Wolff and Impure Thoughts. That's a band I had starting in about 1999, 2000, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe 5 years. And it was really a world band where I had tablas and percussion, Bud Elroy and tablas, maybe Frank Colonna percussion, or this guy Cafe, or Valchino, Anastasio, different percussionists.
Mm-hmm.
John B. Williams, who had been in the Nancy Wilson band, was my bassist. And a couple of different drummers, either Victor Jones or Mike Clark. This is my band. It was a very worldly band.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a really good friend named Linda Goldstein, and I've known her since I was 18. And Linda was Bobby McFerrin's manager for his whole career. She still is.
Oh, cool.
And we were really good friends. In fact, I had an office for a while so I could make noise here in New York in the same as part of her office.
Mm-hmm.
She knew all my bands, and we were really close. And Bobby McFerrin had a concert at the Proms in Royal Albert Hall in London.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was in July or something one year. And it was the African Children's Choir, and they needed a band. And I had played with Bobby on the Arsenio Hall show, and we really liked each other.
Okay.
So she said, would your band do it? I said, absolutely. Are you kidding? So it was a highlight. I'll do it. It'll be a highlight. So we went over there. We were the opening act. We played. It was an awesome set. Then the African Children's Choir came on. They played, just sang a cappella.
Mm-hmm.
And then Bobby came on. He did his a cappella thing. And at the end, we all performed together.
Oh, cool.
And I just love these kids. These kids were young. They were all from Africa. You know, they were very poor, but they were really good. And so I just kept in touch with them, you know. And I saw they were going to be down performing in Florida. And I had written this tune, Tell Me. Oh, it was a vocal, you know, I wrote a lot of vocal tunes. Mm-hmm. I did an album, actually, Dangerous. What was it called? Anyway, I did a vocal album, too, mm-hmm. where I sang. Not a great singer, but I have a lot of soul. You know?
I think so you're a great singer. Yeah, I mean, when you hear your voice on Tell Me, I mean, I love how honest it is. And you have a scratchy, bluesy aspect to your tone, you know?
Yeah, you know, from Louisiana. That's it, man.
Love it.
But so I saw they were going to be down there, and I called Roger. He said, because one of my first girlfriends, we split up. She married Roger, but we all stayed friends, you know. Mm-hmm. Roger Nichols, who was the great engineer. He won all those awards.
Famous.
You know, yeah. Steely Dan, a million things. He created all this electronic stuff.
Right.
So I said, Roger, I want to record this song with these guys, but I can guarantee you they're kids that can't wear headphones. He goes, don't worry about it, man. You know, we don't need to give them headphones. I know how to set these speakers up. So I go down there. We found a studio. He found a studio for me. It was in, I think it might have been in Fort Lauderdale. I can't remember where we were.
I think it was
at.
Criterion in Miami. Yeah,
that's it. Criterion in Miami, right. So I think I might have actually been down there playing the Miami Jazz Festival. There was some reason that we worked it out. Anyway, I went down there and I did the track, and then we had the, I think I may have already done the track. I can't remember, but maybe we did. We did the track there. Mm-hmm. And then he helped me set it up. We just got him to sing. That mm-hmm. just happened like that, you know?
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
We videoed it. They were great, man. I love those kids.
And then would it be cool if I play that song? I know it's a 5-minute cut,
please.
So maybe we'll play
a
little bit.
Yeah.
But let's listen.
That one record, on my vocal record. Yeah, play it.
Yeah, let's play a little bit. This is Tell Me here from Michael Wolf on the Otto D Show. Check it out, and then we'll bring Mike right back on the show.
Come stop this. this rain. Save me, try somehow.
And that was Tell Me from Michael Wolff here on the Otto D Show. Man, what a great track, Michael. I love that song.
You're taking me back. I haven't heard that in a long time. Thanks, man. And loved hearing it.
The kids were incredible.
They were really great kids.
Well, listen, man, what a career you've had. Great family, all in the business, too. But on top of all that, I've never known somebody who's had to deal with Tourette syndrome. I'd love to hear a little bit about that. But before we even go there, you have been dealing with what I believe is called histiocytic sarcoma for years, if I said it right. And I've been reading about it. And 90% of what I read is still medical terms. I can't tell how this manifests itself. So I wondered, can you share how this impacts your daily life?
Well, now I'm cured of it. It's a miracle. I got cured of it about 4 years ago. It was an incurable, untreatable, rare disease that only really about 300 people had had when I got sick with it in about 8 years ago,
something?
Yeah, about 9 years ago, something okay. like that, you know. So maybe 2015 or something
and
like that.
And you were treated for a while for a misdiagnosed version of cancer, correct?
Yeah, I was treated for a type of lymphoma. And, you know, since then, my doctor wrote a paper that there are certain cancers that morph into the histiocytic sarcoma. So it may have actually been what I had when they first diagnosed it, and maybe it changed. Nobody's really sure.
Interesting.
Or it could have been a misdiagnosis because it's so rare. But only 300 people have had it. And the other beings that get it are dogs and boa constrictors. Check that out.
Wow. That's crazy.
So it's tumors, you know, and it's in the, you know, your lymph system.
Mm-hmm.
And I had stage 4, which means it was everywhere in my body. It was, my lungs and my liver and my kidneys and, you know, all over my body.
Yeah, I heard they gave you 3 months was the diagnosis.
Well, when I first got this, lymphoma, they thought, this is the lymphoma. When I first got diagnosed, they said, I wasn't really sick. I just had some swollen lymph nodes. And they said, they did a biopsy. Said, okay, well, you got stage 4, but the type of cell it is isn't bad. And, we'll be able to treat it, not cure it. But, when you get sick, we'll treat it. And it'll probably go away for 3 to 10 years and it'll come back. And, that's what they do. And they were seeming too concerned. So I said, okay. But then when I got sick about a year later, then they started treating it. And after about 6 months of treatment or nine, something like that. Technically, I didn't have any more lymphoma, but I was getting sicker and sicker and sicker. And I wasn't at a Sloan Kettering. So then my wife goes, we got to go up to Memorial Sloan Kettering, which I did. And I went to that lymphoma doctor, and he looked at me, and he looked at my chart, and he goes, well, I don't get it. He was kind of irritated. Why are you so sick? You know, you had the right treatment. It went away, blah, blah, blah. He says, okay, I'm going to do another biopsy. He did. And we went back after that. He goes, okay, here's the Kleenex box. You got something I've never seen. The guy was about 70. You got something I've never seen in my career. Histiocytic sarcoma. It's a very rare disease. I'm going to send you to the rare cancer guy as soon as you can get in. And so that was lucky I got to this guy, Renau Gounder. And, you know, we look, actually, my wife said, whatever you do, don't look it up. Because it said everybody was going to die within 6 months. You know, There was no treatment. And I asked that guy, Gounder, he said, he's a rare guy. I said, cancer guy. I said, well, and I just thought, well, if this guy, if he can't do it at Sloan, I'm going to go down to MD Anderson in Houston or Dana-Farber up at Harvard in Boston. I said, well, who's the person that's seen the most of these cases? He goes, I have. And I said, how many have you seen? He said, 10. And I didn't ask him if they survived. I bet they didn't. So I said, well, am I going to survive? He said, well, I'll fight with you. And I just thought, man, that is not good news, you know?
Yeah.
When I got to Sloan, whenever that was, like maybe, you know, let's say 2015, they were doing a kind of a trial of a blood test called the genome blood test, you know, and they did a blood test and would check out all the mutations in your genome. And they hoped they could find a mutation that would be the reason that you had your cancer and maybe that would lead them to a treatment. So it took 6 weeks in those days for it to come in. Now it doesn't take as long. As the info came in, it came in, and there was just nothing showing up that could help the doctor. And, you know, in the meantime, he had treated me with a really strong chemo that about killed me, and I ended up in the ICU, and I was in the hospital for 3 weeks. And he was just telling my wife, I'm stumped. I don't really know what to do. So we tried some alternatives, vitamin C, IV, and all kind of shit. Oops, sorry, all
That's
kind
okay.
of stuff.
No worries.
And are we on live radio? I'm sorry.
We're live on the internet, so there's no FCC. You're totally
oh,
cool.
Okay, good. I think when it comes to cancer, we should be allowed to swear a little bit. It's so awful.
Absolutely.
Anyway, so, but at the very end, a mutation did come in that he recognized, and he went into the lab with my biopsy and figured it out. And then he went on the computer and he found this drug that related to it, and he gave it to me. And I said to him, well, what's the research? He goes, man, you're the research.
Jeez.
That's it. There's no research. So I took it, and 2 days later, all my symptoms were gone, my chills and my fevers and sweats and, you know, all this stuff. And then I went back to him, and he said, look at the hair on my arm. It's raised. I can't believe it. This is why I get into this world. You know, these guys are Memorial Sloan Kettering are all researchers. They are serious doctors, and they care about it. So he said, let's do a PET scan, you know, to see if you have the cancer. And we go to the next week. He goes, you're not going to believe it. 80% reduction of all the tumors. This is a miracle. Let's keep taking it. So he didn't know how to give it to me. So first we do, you know, one pill every day. Then we do two pills for 3 weeks and then three pills. You know, he tried a million different things to just see what would work. And after about a year, he didn't see any cancer. So I kept taking the pills for another year. And after that, he says, you know, it's been about over a year I've seen no cancer. I say, well, how would I know if I'm cured? He goes, the only way you can know if you're cured is to stop taking the medicine, but that's up to you. I said, I'm out. Stop it. Mm-hmm. And he said, yeah, okay. I think you're totally cured. Not remission. He says, I think we found the key to that lock. I think we've cured it. But, you know, we'll keep checking up on you. If it somehow comes back, we know how to treat it. It never came back. It's been 4 years now. He told me, if you go a year without it coming back, it's never coming back.
That's fantastic.
So there you go. So he did he wrote an article about me in the New England Journal of Medicine explaining the whole thing. Everybody was finding out about it. And all, you know, everybody in the world reads that, you know, on the internet. So all the doctors that dealt with this kind of cancer, because of the different tests, they were starting to discover it more. And they were sending it to him, or he, you know, he was the doctor for it, or he was telling them what to do. So recently, I was seeing him. You know, I just go annually just for a checkup. And I said, "Now, how is it with that disease now?" He says, "Well, we cure everybody."
Wow.
"Because of you, well, we cure everybody."
That's cool.
So it's a miracle, man.
That's pretty cool to be part of that story where it starts.
So that's been 4 years, so I feel like I'm on borrowed time. I got to do something great with my life, you know.
Well,
I don't know if I do, but I'm writing music. I got my sons, you know. I'm just trying to be in the world.
I was
going to
say,
know?
You've done a lot with your life in terms of the content you've created. You've poured your heart into your family, how all of that's passed on, and they're all doing the same thing, creating. I mean, you've made a mark bigger than a whole lot of people. And then on top of that, to be part of this life-saving experience, you know, that's been shared with other people. And now you've got your first book out. So you're not stopping. You're not even slowing down, you know.
Yeah, I'm not complaining. I mean, I'm just feeling very creative these days. And, you know, I love music so much. I feel like when I was a teenager, I just always loved music, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I just do it every day, you know, whatever. I'm teaching NYU, so I have my students there, and I get a lot out of that. I mean, they've learned a whole different way that I learned. You know, they've learned this more academic way. But then I try to show them how I learned it, how I view it, which is different than them. And I learned a lot from them, so I really love it.
Yeah. Well, man, we are out of time. I'm going to have to let you go. But Michael, again,
it was a pleasure, and I didn't even get to ask you any questions about you, though I did read up on you. So one day we're going to have to get in the studio, and you're going to have to produce me doing something.
Hey, man, absolutely. And next time you come through the valley, absolutely reach out. We'll hook up.
All right. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Have a great night. Maybe we'll see you on the West Coast.
All right. Bye-bye.
Take care. You've been listening to The Otto D Show, where my guest has been Michael Wolff. And, man, was that fun. So we'll see you next week. Take care.